Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 23, Text 27. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Mana Bhuhi Mana Svatma. Rapatya Dhanadaya. Yatsampakat Priya Asham Pitako. Nataratya. Translation. It is only by contact with the self that one's vital breath, intelligence, mind, friends, body, wife, children, and so on are dear. Therefore, what object can be possibly more dear than one's own self? Om jnana jimarandasya jnanandana asavataya saksurumbhavitam yena tasmai sri gurave namaha sri chaitanya manobhishtam Tapitam yena bhutale shayam bhuta tadamayam tadati sa tadantikam adadanasya nandante idam yache puna puna shrimad bhuta tadam bhoja uvisham janma janmani parāgi yudhvakti visham piyatnāya Tapayama manabhitamantam, tapambudhiya paradhuka dhubi, sanatanastam padamastrayami, vansha kalpa karubhyasya, kripa sindhu vayevaja, patitanam bhavanebhyo, vaishnavebhyo namo namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So, greetings from Udupi, which is in the state of Karnataka, very far down south. It's in the middle of the winter, but yet it's quite warm. It's a beautiful tropical and lush place, which is famous, or it's the center of Madhvacharya. I believe his birthplace is near here. He studied near here. He's discovered his deity by the ocean here. Udupi Krishna, it's established here. And just by coincidence, their biggest function that happens every 2 years is, I think, going to be on the 14th. I'm sure Amitananda is quite cognizant of that type of function, but the way they've organized their movement is their main center of worship is here in Udupi, and they have 8 acharyas in their movement. And it's a very interesting system, because how the 8 acharyas, they actually have only 16 sannyasis in their whole movement, and I think it's limited to that, I believe. And what they do is they determine by astrology who actually is the most fit for that service of lifetime renunciation. And when one of the acharyas leaves, then he has a junior acharya, which he's appointed, and then that junior acharya becomes the acharya. And then he makes a search, astrological search in his particular district or area for a qualified young man to be his junior acharya. And then they give sannyas. And a lot of times these junior acharyas, you know, they're only 11, 12, 13 years old. And it's interesting because technically when one gets a danda, it's actually his height. So they actually grow a lot more, but their danda stays the same size. And they're very strict. You know, they have to bathe only in a holy river. And you know, they follow, you know, very, very strict and sattvic lifestyle. So their system is that eight acharyas, so every 2 years, one of the acharyas on a rotating basis becomes the acharya for 2 years of the main mutt or the main center. And the rest of the 14 years he collects, and whatever he accrues, he spends in those 2 years for preaching Krishna consciousness, because they're Krishna bhaktas, and we're also in the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, so we're actually in their line. And I don't know that much about, but I yesterday Parthasarthi was telling me that about 15 kilometers from here, there's a kund. When Madhva was studying in school, he was already sannyasi, he took his danda and he put it in the ground because he was thirsty. Because of course he was, I believe, an incarnation of Bhima. And water came out. So in that kund, it's very amazing, like late at night, maybe in the evening or something, about 8 o'clock, I don't know, or something, on the 14th, the acharya bathes in that kund, and then there's this long, it's practically as long as Govardhan Hill, this long procession that goes all through the night, and somehow I think they get into the main mutt about 1 o'clock in the morning, and evidently there's palanquins of every spiritual group in South India. So we're here in that very, very holy place. And I guess because of the South Indian culture and the climate, it seems to also be a place of healing. And many of my godbrothers are taking treatment right now, yes, last night. Because I try to give you a feel for the place that I'm staying, to try to make this particular type of medium, which has a particular nature, which is passionate. I can tell you that from trying to give the classes and not being able to see anybody and then meeting the resistance of reverberation and technical problems. But I try to get a sense of the play. Last night, I did this the last two nights, I went to a Niranjan Swami staying, and we did kirtan. And Jayadvaita Swami's taking this treatment, and Parthasarthi Prabhu, and Varsana Maharaj, he's already been here for 2 months, taking that treatment. Niranjan Swami, yeah, so Tejas Prabhu, and Bhujan Prabhu will come on the 14th just for a few days for some other reason. And I'm here until the 17th. So it's actually amazing. Just all are very, very close to me. So the association is wonderful. And, of course, the kirtan is wonderful. And it just gave me a sense also, it's kind of connected to this, is... Yeah, I'm a little bit apprehensive today's class, because when I started the classes, it was after I was in Govardhan for 1 month. So that was the maximum time of the year for me for regulation, for focus, for realization, etc. And then, you know, when you travel, regulation goes, and therefore focus becomes more difficult, study becomes more difficult, bhajan becomes more difficult, and therefore the realizations are not as deep. So I was thinking of this also with all these devotees that are not ill, and how they it's interesting, because generally in Ayurveda, I'm learning a little bit about that here because I'm staying with this Ayurvedic doctor. And in Ayurveda, I'll get to the Krishna Leela, but I think this is relevant, that, you know, people who are thin, they're vata nature. And if they get illness, a lot of times with nerves and things like that, but a lot of illness is caused by vata disturbance. So in the modern age, you know, you have sannyasis, and they're all kind of, most of them, if you look at those people, they're all thin, and they have vata constitutions. And what happens is when you travel, one of the things that happens is that vata increases. And this Ayurvedic doctor was telling me that, you know, in previous ages, what a traveling sannyasi meant is that he walked from village to village. You know, so when he got to the next place, he was in the same environment. He didn't change his environment so rapidly. And the Ayurvedic doctor was mentioning also that when you change your environment, it takes you 72 hours to physiologically adjust to the environment. And he said that then when you move faster than a bullock cart, it blows out the fire of digestion. So you can imagine what it does going in an airplane or a car. So the modern life of a sannyasi, physically, is a tremendous sacrifice. And I honor these people that made such tremendous sacrifice and continue to do so. But now that they're over 50, they realize that perhaps some adjustments will have to be made. It's just because I could see some of them are regaining their health. You know, but, you know, who knows if it's the treatment or just the fact that they're staying in one place for a month and getting a regular diet. The Ayurvedic doctor said also that, if you eat at regular times, you know, consistently, then practically said you can digest arsenic. I wouldn't mean that literally, but it's just that type of lifestyle. And I think all of them are just thinking. I just spoke to Jayadvaita Swami. You know, he just was in Mayapur teaching in the Institute of Higher Education. He's going back afterwards just to hear their life in a more practical way and somehow reduce the traveling, which so much agitates the source of their sickness. Okay, we'll get into today's class. So Krishna here is speaking to the wives of the Brahmins, and I don't want to go all the way back to the beginning every time for the class, because hopefully most of you are coming regularly, but maybe we can just focus in meditation on just one of the scenes and build there, and then get down to these instructions to Krishna. These instructions are by Krishna to the wives of the Brahmins who have now sacrificed everything to come to him. And Krishna, who is Akhila Drip Drasta, he sees our vision. Of course, vision is not just a question of the senses, it's a question of consciousness. Otherwise, there practically would be no disagreement, because from the standpoint of the senses, everyone's seeing the same thing, so why do they disagree? Because your vision is affected by your consciousness, which means your intelligence and your nature. So Krishna actually sees, how are we seeing the world? Are we seeing the world as ours and meant for our enjoyment? Are we seeing the world as Krishna's and meant for his service? It's such an enlightening point, deep point, but just imagine that Krishna is seeing our vision. and just look at your heart and then see, how do you see the world? How are you reacting to the world? How do you see the world? How do you see your future? What are your hopes? What are your desires? Krishna sees that, and that's what Krishna accepts. So when we see these wives of the Brahmins, Tepvasarva Asa, they've given up all other hopes except for the pleasure of Krishna, because their intelligence, and Krishna is seeing this. Krishna actually not only see it, he told the cowherd boys when they came back after they failed to beg food for him from the Brahmins, whose hopes, asa means hopes, what are their hopes? Ashudra asa. Their hopes are for petty, temporary things in this world. And the petty, temporary things in this world were in the name and form of Buri Burini Karmani, so many elaborate rituals, which had the form of sacrifice, which is surrendered to God, but actually the consciousness behind that was petty hopes. They wanted material pleasure. They wanted fruitive activity. So Krishna is telling the wives of the Brahmins, he's telling the cowherd boys when they come back, they failed in their begging because these Brahmins had such material aspirations and therefore material consciousness, and therefore they had material vision. Although they had all the elaborate ingredients for the sacrifice, which are all Krishna's opulence, they didn't recognize what was Krishna's position. Even when the cowherd boys came and said, Krishna is nearby. So he said, Krishna says, no, there's a difference. Don't worry, you failed with the Brahmins, but you won't fail to live with their wives. Because Snigdha Mayi Ushitadiya, they're affectionate, and because they're affectionate, their intelligence resides in me. Their intelligence resides in me and my desires. So automatically, just seeing my servants, they'll be inspired to serve me. So let's just go back, just to put this story in context, and envision when the wives of the Brahmins finally saw Krishna. Don't just envision their form, but envision and see their heart. Because from hearing about Krishna for extended periods of time, they cultivated an intense desire to see him. And they'd never saw him before. They were in separation, which increased that desire. And their hearing was so pronounced that it became the ornaments for their ears, our ears, the ornament. We should all think, the ornament for our ears, the thing that will actually give our ears glory, is when those ears are used extensively to hear about Krishna. And this story tells us the result. The result of extensively hearing for Krishna is your asha. Your hopes will no longer become petty. Your hopes will become, your hopes will be for something real and substantial, the eternal absolute reality, Sri Krishna, which actually can satisfy the heart, which actually can give us shelter. So this is the process. So we can see in the wives of the Brahmins, someone who had perfect hearts, perfect beings, as Prabhupada said, the perfected state of the living entity is called a devotee. Prabhupada didn't think the term devotee was an ordinary thing. It's the perfected state of the living entity where there's priti in the heart, where the living entity just desires intensely to please Krishna, which is the dharma or nature of the soul. And they're eager for Krishna, and they're eager to love Krishna. So after all this, we had that vision where the cowherd boys, we can see it, came to them and said, Krishna is nearby. And just by their, they had such eagerness that Krishna was near, for Krishna, from this extensive hearing that they fainted, and they moved spontaneously to see Krishna, even though their husbands tried to forbid them. Their husbands tried to stop them. Their husbands desired to stop them from Krishna, from the lotus feet of Krishna was defeated by the intense hopes and desires of these wives of the Brahmins, which was cultivated by hearing about Krishna for a long time. So it's so nicely, this story is outlining and highlighting the process of Krishna consciousness. It's all focused on the heart and the desire. And the process of spiritual life is transforming that desire. And the chief way to transform that desire is to take the consciousness and focus it on that absolute reality. Initially, it's by Vaidhi Bhakti. Our intelligence is fixed up, and we understand that by following the rules and injunctions of Shastra, it will benefit us. By following the dictations of Guru and Krishna, will benefit us. But the process is eventually by focusing the mind on Krishna, a natural desire and liking for Krishna will come in the heart, like these wives of Brahmins, and it'll be eager. It'll be your chief desire and heart. Just like now, we can ourselves meditate on what is the burning desire in our heart? What's really disturbing us? What do we actually really want now? But that intensity of desire that we have perhaps right now for material things, we can magnify that same intense, spontaneous desire they have for Krishna. And then finally, when the cowherd boys come and say, Krishna is nearby, he's strolling by the bank of the Jamuna, and he's begging some food for you, and such enthusiasm, they took beautiful preparations, perhaps that were meant for the sacrifice, and understood, just by their simple heart, what these learned Brahmins couldn't understand. They understood the highest principle of philosophy, that everything is Krishna's energy and meant for his service. And therefore, immediately, they took these aromatic and tasty and colorful and flavorful looking, and they're running towards Krishna, and now they've actually seen Krishna. So we can envision what is their heart. And it described that when they saw Krishna, they embraced him through the apertures of the eyes. They took that image that they were longing for, and they took it into the heart. And just as a yogi, a real spiritual yogi, gives up false ego by embracing the inner consciousness, which is the absolute reality, and therefore the false ego. This is the whole process of yoga. The process of yoga is yoga chitta vritti nirodha, that by neglecting the material consciousness and focusing away from it, hopefully on the absolute reality, you give up the false ego. So they've given up their separation now. They've taken Krishna into their hearts due to that intense yearning. And they're with him, and they're looking right at him. And what do they see? They see his beautiful form with his yellow garment. And now it says, they saw that he was dressed as a dramatic actor. I ask everyone now to just meditate on that for a few minutes. It just shows you how your frame of reference affects your hearing and your perception, and how we have to hear about Krishna so we actually have the proper frame of reference, so that when we hear something, we can actually have the right visions and thoughts about it. I have to say myself, I'm trying to figure, what does it mean? If anybody who's there would like to write something and send me an email, what do you think it means that Krishna was dressed like a dramatic actor? Certainly dashing and beautiful, and I guess dramatic, it means that it could invoke some, dramatic perhaps, is that his dress is meant to invoke a sentiment. Perhaps his dress is there to please Srimati Radharani. And therefore, he wears a golden dress, which is her color, just as Radharani wears a blue dress, which is Krishna's color. So we already see that perhaps his dress is reflecting his heart, which is his love for Srimati Radharani. And we know that Srimati Radharani, her dramatic dress, is that she wants Krishna to be pleased by her beauty. And therefore she puts on jewels which are Mahabhav Sarup, non-different from her own internal essence, which is actually to please Krishna. And she puts those jewels on her heads and her anklets and her, and it's expressing, it's Krishna, I am beautiful, I am making myself beautiful because I want to please you. And therefore her whole dress is composed of Mahabhav Sarup, the form of the desire to intensely please Krishna. So we can also assume that Krishna, perhaps his dramatic dress, is also the color and the of Radharani, and also their dress beautiful to please his devotees who love Krishna and love Krishna's form and love things that highlight Krishna's form. So we see, and then of course Krishna, this is very, very intimate. When they see Krishna, Krishna is relaxed. He's very much in a premi bhakti mood. He's very, very relaxed. He's not formal at all. He has his hand and he's kind of leaning with his hand on his friend, perhaps just like the Krishna Balaram deities in Vrindavan have that mood with Balaram. He's leaning there and he's twirling this Lila Kamala, which is representing their hearts and his hearts. So just see what they're feeling. And this should be our aspiration. We should see the hopes in our hearts, the material things, and in the practical, and our hopes in our heart, and our eagerness for Krishna. And we should make a practical plan, by the gradual process of Krishna consciousness, specifically by chanting and hearing about Krishna, by absorbing ourselves in Krishna, to increase these hopes and expectations, because our distance from Krishna is only our hopes and expectations to see him. This is the key, one of the key points in Krishna consciousness that Uddhava gave to the gopis. Krishna gave to the gopis through Uddhava. I am there by my bhava manifestation. So Krishna, who's the absolute reality, there's nothing outside of Krishna. He's only blocked from us by our lack of desire to be with him. So our whole life is focused as devotees on that desire. Not renunciation, because we may have to keep some things for our own nature and integration so that we can be strong in heart to focus on Krishna. But the goal is that desire and hope to see Krishna. And we have to look in our hearts. We have to see what we have to honestly assess what is our desire, and we have to lament that perhaps it's not such a strong desire, and we have to honor and glorify and worship these devotees that have that desire in their hearts, and we have to aspire for it, and therefore undertake the activities which could bring us to that same consciousness. So here they are, and Krishna is so happy. He's smiling because he sees the pure desire of these wonderful devotees of him. In the previous class, I mentioned this point of that young man. He was telling me this one commentary that when the soul, when the living entity comes to Vrindavan, the nature of Prakriti awakens in his heart. Right now, whether we are male or female externally, Material consciousness means pollution. I am the controller. I am the enjoyer, which is an unnatural position for the soul. And therefore, the soul remains dissatisfied when it tries to be happy on the platform of purusha, because it's an illusion that we're purusha. And therefore, the happiness we get is also dreamlike or illusory. When I was thinking of this, Prabhupada in one purport gave the example, I believe it is in India, the poor people in India, as the British built the railroads and kind of infiltrated their culture with Western materialism, but still they're very, very poor, and I'm just like amazed. I really got absorbed in this lecture because I'm just amazed because there's a hot glass of milk next to me that wasn't there beforehand. That means that someone had come into the room right before me and put it, and I didn't notice it. But so Prabhupada gave this this example that you'll see in India. You know, when you go past the movie theater, you'll see many poor people because they'll just be bicycles in these little tiffins. And what happens, and then you'll see outside a big sign, generally it'll have either a painting of a beautiful Bollywood starlight and some hero or something. So what happens, the Indian system is not such upward mobility as there is in the West even today. And then there's such a disparity of income. But now people are seeing it because even in Vrindavan, you go around Govardhan Parikram, every tea stall has a television. So people are kind of getting aware. But what happens is they can never achieve their desires. So what do? They go to a movie. And the nature of a movie, it allows you to actually identify. This is the whole nature of drama. And why we actually read Rasa Shastra, because we want to identify with the pure devotees and have that type of sentiment within our heart, which is communicated by, if you're qualified and you hear in the proper way. So you see in these movie theaters so many poor people. So what happens? The desires have been in their hearts that you should get a Hollywood beauty, Miss World, a Miss Universe, etc., and you should be a big hero. And then what happens? They go to these movies and they watch it and they have a sense. When you watch the movie, that I have romance like that, that I am actually like a hero like that. But it's cheap thrills because it's not, they're actually still very, very poor. They never really got the girl. They never really solved the master spy plot that was to overthrow India. So it's the same thing with us. If we try to enjoy on the platform of Purusha, it's not actually us. We're not the controller. We're not the enjoyer. When we have that desire that we're the enjoyer and controller, then Krishna allows us to fulfill that desire by identifying with the body. But what happens on that bodily platform and in that consciousness of I am the enjoyer and controller never really happens to us in the soul. So when you come, it's described, when you come to Vrindavan, this commentary was that the desire for prakriti arises in your heart. And the desire for prakriti is the desire of the soul. That I want to, I'm not the enjoyer, I am the enjoyed. I am the servant. I am the lover of that absolute reality. And we know that this position is such a high position of enjoyment. Because actually the servant or the lover has a higher flavor of enjoyment than the master or beloved. The one who is actually having love come from his heart enjoys that love more than the person who is enjoying that love from the standpoint of being the object of that love or the beloved. So we know even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or Krishna wants to take that position of Prakriti. And we see in this story that the wives naturally have that position. The wives of the Brahmins, even in relationship to their husbands, they have taken that position in one sense. They naturally, that simple heart, that simple desire, and therefore they're achieving perfection. And now I'll get up to today's verse. I have about 15 more minutes. Krishna sees them, and he's so happy that he welcomes them. And he says, Mahabhaga, you're so fortunate. She says, this is the greatest fortune. And he tells him, please sit down. What can I do for you? Make yourself comfortable. And now the verses we're discussing now is Krishna's explaining, because he said that upapanam idam hi, on your part, this is certainly fitting, that you have actually given up everything to come here. Don't think it's not. This is actually fitting. And then as we I'm almost up to today's verse, and then Krishna, very surprisingly, we discussed this last time, becomes very, very philosophical, because it's so intimate, and Krishna, their love is so intimate, and Krishna is responding, but generally, when that intimate love flows towards Krishna, he tends not to manifest his opulence in the presence of such prema. We see that now. You can imagine if two lovers met, and then the man would say, in a very intimate setting, and I am the CEO of the General Motors, and I am 6'4", and I have... It's not appropriate in an intimate relationship, but for the sake of pastime, because in this pastime, what Krishna wants to do is he wants to take, because their bodies as Brahmin ladies are inappropriate for intimate relationship with Krishna. So he wants to invoke separation for the sake of the pastime. We describe that in Vrindavan, the Leela Shakti is supreme. And therefore, the Krishna's Leela Shakti, which is independently acting to create the Leelas and pastimes that give Krishna Akila Rasamrita Murti, a variety of spiritual pleasure and a variety of enjoyment and love, he subdues Krishna's Rakti, the intimacy, and gives Krishna discrimination to explain his position and to show himself as God. So he explains, why is it fitting? Now we have to understand also Krishna's Leela in this world is for two reasons. One, there's a special flavor of the Leela in the material world, just like there's a special quality of a candle in darkness. There's a special flavor of Krishna's Leela in this world, and he's also having his Leela in pastime to attract the conditioned souls. So the Leela Shakti, it gives Krishna the varieties of pleasure in his Leela, but it also suitably moves the pastimes to give the proper instructions to those hearing them so they can come to the highest platform of devotional service. So it gives him the discrimination. And he says it is fitting because those who are kushala, those who actually are expert or clever or have discrimination, svartha darshina, who know their svartha, who perceive their svartha, which is their own benefit, who can actually perceive what is their own true benefit, they'll understand that the highest benefit is unmotivated devotional service, that you serve Krishna not for anything else except that you want to please Krishna, and you do that without any interruption because Krishna is most dear to the soul. And then in today's verse, and I'll speak for 10, 15 minutes more, in today's verse he says, Krishna is again explaining this, it is only by contact with the self that one's vital breath, intelligence, mind, friends, body, wife, children, wealth, and so on are dear. So he gives a very nice example. What makes something dear? It's the soul. And the gopis, actually, I explained before that the verses of Krishna speaking to the wives of the Brahmins actually parallel, sometimes word for word, the instructions and the response of Krishna when the gopis, after hearing his flute, came running and left everything to come see him. So the same point is there. Krishna told the gopis that, you know, you should be chaste to your husband. And then the gopis were basically saying, well, what is my husband? Is it that body? Because, you know, when he dies, we'll put him on the funeral pyre and we'll burn that body. So what is actually my husband is what? The soul. And what is the soul? The soul is spiritual consciousness. It's part of Krishna. So you're actually the most dear. So he's saying here, what gives the vital breath, the intelligence, mind, friends, body, everything, what makes them dear is the soul. So what object can be more dear than the soul? And what makes the soul dear? If the value of the body is the soul, then what is the value of the soul? The value of the soul is the super soul. So what actually can be, it's fitting to dedicate your life completely to the absolute reality. It's fitting to make that the highest priority, the highest objective of life. And the Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning way, is the same instructions. It gives different levels of religion, but what is the highest priority? The highest priority is to give up everything else and surrender to Krishna in an appropriate way. Of course, we saw in the Bhagavad Gita what that meant. Sarva dharmam prityaja mame kam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksayasyami masa. Surrender to me, give up everything, I will protect you, don't fear. But it's very interesting that when Krishna said that to Arjuna and Arjuna surrendered, then what did Krishna say? Krishna said, well, then you should fight and you shouldn't become a renunciate. He surrendered completely, and then Krishna told him, okay, this is what your nature is. Now give everything to me. He didn't tell him to give up his nature inappropriately. So that full surrender to Krishna, and that understanding that he's shelter, it means that to surrender ourselves fully to Krishna's authority as it's coming in Guru Parampara, and then when we surrender fully to that, then we're engaged appropriately to make maximum progress towards that ultimate goal. Therefore, what object can be possibly more dear than oneself? And I'll do the next verse, because I should do at least three verses every time. Tadhyata deva yajanam atyoho vijataya spasatram parayisyanti yushma biyagriha medina. You should thus return to the sacrificial arena, because your husbands, the learned Brahmins, are householders and need your assistance to finish their respective sacrifice. You should return home. Why? Of course, they're going to be very upset with this instruction, and there's a reason why they're upset. But basically what Krishna is saying, yes, don't think that the body and the relatives are not also dear, because What makes something dear is the self. So the self, the soul, has made those things dear, and they should be used appropriately, and therefore you should return. And also, you've achieved now all success by your eagerness. You've actually seen me. This is completely parallel to when the gopis came to see Krishna in many ways. There's some differences. And my God, they'll say, why should we go? Why should we go? And then Krishna says, well, out of mercy. Because your mercy for your husbands, and together with the sacrifice, you will accomplish your duties properly, which are meant for me. And even therefore, even in that sacrifice, in the proper consciousness, even in that sacrifice, you'll see me. Now, we'll do one more verse, and this is actually one of the most important verses, because it completely parallels the reaction of the wives of the Brahmins' reaction to what Krishna says. Completely parallels the reaction of the gopis. So it says, Sri Patya Uchu, Maivam Vibo, Pati Bhavan Gatitum, Nishamsam, Satyam Kurushva Nigamam, Tavaparamulam, Patam Bayam, Tulusi Dhamma Tada, Parishtam Keshai Navodum, Ati Langa Samasta Bandhum. The wives of the Brahmins reply, this is word for word what the gopi said, Maivam, not like this, Arati, Bhavan. You ought not to be like this. Vadikam, speaking, Nisham, so harshly. You shouldn't speak like this so harshly. And why? Satyam Kurushva, because please make Satyam true, Nigamam, the promise given in the revealed scriptures. So what does Nigamam mean? Nigama refers to the Vedas. And what is the promise of the Vedas? It states that one who surrenders at the lotus feet of Krishna does not return to this material world. So we're saying we come to your lotus feet and you promise that one who comes to your lotus feet does not return. But we should see, what is their feeling when they sacrifice everything and they come to Krishna and they see that beautiful form, and with the aperture of their eyes, they take it into their heart. And now Krishna says, no, just do your duties. Now you go home. And they reply, Vibhu, oh almighty Lord, please do not speak such cruel words. Rather, you should fulfill your promise that you always reciprocate with your devotees in kind. Now that we have attained your lotus feet, Tadaparamulam, the base of your lotus feet, Prapta, we have attained that. Now that we've attained, we simply wish to remain here in the forest so we may carry upon our heads the garland of tulsi leaves. You may neglectfully kick away from your lotus feet. We are ready to give up all material relationship. So just see the consciousness of a devotee, how much he values Krishna. How much he values Krishna so much that any connection with Krishna is mercy. In other words, I gave that almost like a formula, that mercy is the distance between what you're getting and your qualification for it. So they see Krishna as so high that being connected to him in any way is mercy. So they're saying, we've attained your lotus feet. Okay, you're saying go home to your husbands. And okay, we simply remain here and just to carry in our heads the garlands of tulsi leaves that you may have neglectfully kick away from your lotus feet. Imagine a pure devotee when he just gets charanamrita and there's a tulsi leaf that has washed Krishna's feet. what do you think? The example of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati is that even when his disciple would be carrying Jagannath Mahaprasad, he would value that so much that he would circumambulate even his disciple. And just think of the humility and the glory that this is actually the Sri Rupa Goswami wrote this, what is it, Archana Pratiti, the step-by-step path of worship. And I believe I've mentioned this before. It has three parts. First one glorifies Krishna. This is the process. You glorify Krishna. In your consciousness, you put spiritual phenomena as high as possible, and it is as high as possible. And then one reflects on his own spiritual position as separate from Krishna, invoking humility in his heart. And that conscious distancing or space between Krishna and himself invokes a mercy in his heart. It evokes a feeling of mercy just to be connected with Krishna. And then when that sense of Krishna's mercy starts to swell in the heart, then one is feeling that, then one begs for Krishna's mercy. Even though one's feeling unqualified, this is actually a symptom of bhava. It's called asabandha. Asabandha means, an advanced devotee, it's hope against hope. The no hope is one's condition. The hope is Krishna is so glorious, he's also merciful. And therefore, by his mercy, I can still attain what I'm not qualified for. And this is the consciousness that the devotee keeps in his heart. I'll tell that story 1,000 times, but I was once with Giriraj Swami just before he was leaving India when he was getting kicked out. We had to go through it. It was June. We had Divya Snan, which is very auspicious, which means rain when there's no clouds. And it's one of the auspicious paths, Divya Snan. And he was telling me all these wonderful stories about his intimate relationship with Prabhupada and how Prabhupada showed him so much love. And when I was just marveling at the amount of mercy he got from Prabhupada, and I said to him, Maharaj, I said, how did you get so much of Prabhupada's mercy? I was astounded. And he looked at me as in this sweet, affectionate, and thoughtful way that Giriraj Swami, those of you who have been fortunate enough to get his association, he looked at me and said, I am just a mercy case. It's so nice, Krishna consciousness, the disqualification becomes the qualification if you realize it. When we were doing kirtan yesterday at Niranjan Swami's apartment, a place, it's actually very, very nice. I mean, it's kind of modern place and big hall, but around it is all these coconut trees and, you know, this tropical weather. We're doing kirtan, and then afterwards he said, Marge, speak something about the holy name. So I was speaking at the end of Bhakti Sandarbha. An amazing point was made. The question was, that Jiva Goswami wanted to make, is that the holy name, it's the Yuga Dharma in Kali Yuga, but it doesn't mean it was any less potent in Satya Yuga. The holy name is always potent, not any less potent in Satya Yuga. So Jiva Goswami is explaining this point, that why it's the Yuga Dharma, because of course Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave it, and there's many reasons why this process is so powerful. The holy name is more merciful than his form, because just like if someone's worshiping the deity, you have to go to the deity to see the form of the deity. But if the person is doing kirtan, then the kirtan will go to you, and kirtan actually enters into our body. There's many reasons why nam-kirtan is the most powerful and merciful process. And therefore, Jiva Goswami gives this wonderful statement that I memorized. It's just so wonderful. He says, devotion in the form of kirtan is unlimitedly merciful to those who are devoid of prestige. devotion in the form of kirtan, unlimited. And then he described that in Kali Yuga, no one should be proud. He said the most, he quoted from some shastra, the most learned of the learned, relatively speaking, know nothing in this age. The most aristocratic of the aristocratic are relatively not cultured at all in this age. The charitable of the charitable. He goes and he says, if we can recognize our lack of qualification and actually accept that because we're born in Kali Yuga, Kaler Doshe Nidhe Rajan, it's an ocean of fault. He said, then that becomes the ornament of humility. Our lack of qualification realized becomes the ornament of humility, and then devotion in the form of kirtan shows its mercy to those who are devoid of false prestige. So, look at the consciousness here. We retain, we simply wish, and Vishnu, I'll finish with this, gives a, Thakur gives a thing that Krishna has pointed out. You young ladies are members of the aristocratic Brahmin community, so how can you surrender at a mere cowherd boy? To this, the ladies have replied, since we have already surrendered at your lotus feet, and since we desire to become your servants, we are obviously not maintaining a false identification as members of so-called Brahmin community. We've given up this. We can easily ascertain this. You can see from our words, we don't identify with that at all. Krishna replied, well, I am a cowherd boy, and my proper maid servants and girlfriends are the gopis. And the wives humbly say, true, let them be. Let them shine forth if you're embarrassed in front of your relatives to make Brahmin ladies your maid servants. Because Krishna is Gowala. He's the cowherd boy. This is not to dark, not high caste in India, always with animals, to have Brahmin servants. We don't want to embarrass you. We will not go to your village, but rather we'll remain in the forest of Vrindavan like the presiding deity. We simply desire to perfect our lives by even a slight trace of connection with you. A slight case of connection. Kick away from your lotus feet the tulsi leaves, and if we can get, and look at Lord Brahma. He valued Krishna after he came to his realization. Lord Brahma is such a nice example for our spiritual realization, because Lord Brahma, when he actually saw who Krishna was, when Krishna manifested all his opulence, then Lord Brahma was lamenting. This is actually the beginning of spiritual life. You look back and you lament.
Please note that your conference will expire in
10
minutes.
Okay, thank you. We're going to finish now then. That he looked back, Brahma, and he looked how he was acting on the basis of false ego. And he lamented. And we should also look back on what our life was on the basis of false ego. And we should see right now how our life is being affected by false ego. And looking back. So even Lord Brahma, he was lamenting, and he saw the glories of spiritual phenomena, of truth, of reality. And he was praying, let me even be a piece of grass in Vrindavan. And Uddhava, who was the top devotee outside of Vrindavan, the chief disciple of Brihaspati, the guru of all the demigods, wanted to be some grass in Vrindavan. To see the devotee's mood of gratitude in relationship to Krishna. And I really feel very strongly that in Prabhupada's process of looking at our condition and seeing our heart and our samskaras and our nature, that really by preaching Jiva Doi Krishna Nam Sarva Dharma Sar, that the essence of all religion is to show compassion for the conditioned souls by giving them the holy name, that Prabhupada was very, very much understanding that the nature of compassion and gratitude was an essential component of our spiritual practices to enable us to experience mercy and to appreciate mercy and therefore to feel love. So I'm going to end here for now. I went a little bit over. Everybody, you have your schedules. You always have the option to chime out. So I'll just stay on for a few minutes because it's here. It's 8:45, and I'm doing a few things here which are interesting.